have this commitment and orientation to a self, but it doesn't have to be that way. And you know, the example of that Aboriginal, it's a reminder of that, is you know, that's a possibility. I think one of the things about the DS tragedy that's really important, though, is that any possibility is just that, it's one possibility. And even a possibility in which you're at one with nature, you know, and that opens up new possibilities. And it really is a different way of being. In TSK talk, you'd say, well, that's a second level. That's what I usually talks about, the second level of time and space and knowledge. And it may be, in many ways, much more enriching and fulfilling than our ordinary way of being, in which we accept this kind of technological model of knowledge. But what's most important from a TSK perspective is the kind of complete freedom that underlies that, to be any way at all. And if you touch that freedom, then our ordinary way of being is okay too. You know, we just are not committed to it. We just are not committed to this very self-centered way of being.
Mm-hmm. I have maybe a heretical thought.
Yeah.
There's an intermediate zone, it seems to me, as we're talking, between the vision of TSK and our commitment to self. The path or trajectory between our self-centered commitment to self and vision. And I'm wondering if there's some way that we might touch on, maybe it's something Sudhabe said yesterday too, how we can firm up our direction to, I hate to use such a linear picture, mm-hmm. but, you know, how it applies mm-hmm. to us in mm-hmm. particular. You know, we're all sitting in here, all different, each having our own issues about how to incorporate this or how to surrender to it. And I'm just thinking, would it be helpful to anyone else in here to discuss even briefly, you know, what our individual issue might be, what our struggle might be to get to that? Because abstractly, I understand it, but I don't know where necessarily I get caught. And I can do that on my own, but I'm just wondering if it would be at all useful to talk about, I don't know if it's a path or, you know, what obstacles mm-hmm. Come in the way between this ordinary self and this masterful, right. encompassing vision. And maybe the obstacles might be useful to talk about. If it's too personal or too, you know, individual, it takes away from the larger vision, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think all of our individual paths,
mm-hmm.
it's life, our life path, our own conditioning, the way we've been raised, the limits we've been raised with. I love Norbu, and one of the things he said in one of the books he wrote was that your life journey is your path of awakening, your own. I mean, every obstacle you come up against in your life, it might be familiar to others. I mean, we all share common human conditioning and things like that, but it's just life.
I understand that, and I appreciate that. The thing that I was just being interested in, if somebody has a particular, well, I mean, I said it already, you know, it's too general. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's a generality that escapes, you know, the direction. When I leave here, I want to feel like, boom, I've, you know, moved an inch to the left
mm-hmm.
on this particular thing. What mm-hmm. my obstacles? I know the general
right.
path.
Right.
So I'm not sure how to do that, or if it's relevant. It sounds like, you know, you're dealing with it in your life, and I certainly am, and I'm sure everybody else is too. But it's just, I was just thinking of a little switch or a link to interconnect that.
Well, it seems to me there's you know, two issues there. One of them has to do with the constructs we use to make sense of our world in kind of a philosophical sense. That word may not strike everybody as right, but you know, your sense of what's real, what has value, what you want to be doing with your life. I'm trying to distinguish that off from what you might think of as a kind of a personal, psychological set of concerns. So that would be the second, is the personal, psychological sense. I think both of them are fair game for discussion. But I think what I'd like to try to encourage people to do is bring that up. You know, we have lots of opportunities. I mean, we certainly build it into what we do for people to talk about their own experience and their own concerns and issues. I think I'd rather do it that way. But it is, you know, you do need to become very familiar with yourself. Somebody, I guess it was Eugene, said on Sunday night that you really appreciated Knowledge of Freedom as a kind of, this wasn't your word, but as a gateway into TSK, right? And I think of it that way sometimes. It was written in 1984, or published in 1984, so 7 years after the first TSK book, but right before Love of Knowledge. It was when Rinpoche finished Knowledge of Freedom, he turned to Love of Knowledge. So especially there's a connection, you could say, between those two books. And I think it's the blurb on the back of one of the editions of Knowledge of Freedom says something that I've always thought was nice. It says that what Knowledge of Freedom offers is a universal autobiography. That is a kind of a necessary prerequisite for investigating this vision, or sounds like you can go into the vision quite deeply without doing that. But at a certain point, I think you need to see how your particular self functions, but more in these kind of universal terms. And that's actually something we want to look at this morning. And then, you know, there's the particulars for you. And
yeah, I mean, I see that. It's just that, you know, sometimes I find, even at classes at NEMAS, sometimes that there's a nodding appreciation for the universal and no discussion of the link between, you know, except occasionally. And I become suspicious of how much people themselves, you know, what their journeys are. It's not that I want to go into everybody's, you know, private exploration, nor would I like it in that direction, but I do feel questioning and maybe a little suspicious of, well, are we just nodding? Mm-hmm. You know, yes, we understand. I mean, I'm not sure how to do that. You know, if somebody has an issue with an illness, you know, life-threatening illness, or somebody has an issue with a child, or somebody has an issue with a job, you know, okay, this is not to be ignored or to be explored psychologically necessarily in here, but, you know, it's like living in this area for a long time. Everybody knows every book and every Vipassana group and everything. So where, you know, what's the changing place? What's the transforming moment? You know, how do you make the steps? How honest can you actually be? You know, and so it's not, maybe this is not the forum, but it occurs to me as you're talking, you know, how much I appreciate that, and yet I don't know, you know, I want to rub elbows with, well, how are you doing it? You know, what are you doing? You know, we do a little practice, and then, well, how'd you do on the practice? Mm-hmm. Where'd you come up against it? And again, it's not the happening cabin group because
that's right.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. So as I say, however you want to do it, it's just that
Well, I think it's a good point. I think that you know, this is one of the questions that comes up. I'm familiar with it more in a Buddhist context, I guess, and not so much, and you're right, Nyingma, where we kind of, I wouldn't say discourage that, but we don't encourage it. But you do see it discussed in many different forums. You know, people who are interested in Buddhism don't, what is their relationship to a kind of therapy for the self? You know, don't you need to kind of heal the self before you can then address the limitations of the self? Because if you don't, then the self is always kind of retreating back into its painful, secret, hidden places.
I had to do that through recovery. I had 2 years, the first 2 years of my recovery in alcohol and drug addiction, I had to just dive into the emotional abuse and the emotional illness that I was involved in. And it was a struggle. It was hard. 2 years of it, facing myself and becoming honest. It's just, that's the easier, softer way. There is no other easier, softer way than to just simply get to know myself and be honest with myself. And that opens up awareness to where, if you want to say there's a link to joy or a link to experiencing that momentarily bliss or whatever, that's the link. When you clear your psychological, and that first book is very helpful with that too.
The knowledge of freedom.
Yeah, of your psychological issues. That clears awareness, and then you are able to just be free in the moment and enjoy that bliss and that joy of being that Rinpoche talks about so much, about living in that new way of being.
Thank you. You know, you said something last night, Jackie, that Rinpoche liked the idea of the slogan, be here now. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by be, or what do you mean by here, or what do you mean by now? Mm-hmm. That's what I feel is the definitions, you know, maybe predicated on a deeper communication with ourselves, with each other in some way. You know, I don't know the format or the forum, and I hear you, and I certainly hear what you're saying. So it's not that I'm needing myself the opportunity to talk about my obstacles, but I just think that maybe some linking might be.
Well, there may be. Okay. But I do think that when people are, you know, discussing their experience with an exercise, that realm, I mean, I do want to make it clear, I guess, that the realm of kind of personal issues, or however you want to frame that, does not have to be left aside, or, you know, it's not like that's an illegitimate topic. It's legitimate. Okay. So, one practical issue, we had talked about going ahead and starting at 2 again today because today's the only day that it has any relevance. But I wanted to bring that up again because Deborah and Lois, you felt kind of strongly that you wanted to have more time, and nobody else seemed to have a strong feeling about it that I could sense yesterday. So I'm wondering if maybe we should start at 2:30 instead today.
And when would we go into Enso?
It'd be the same.
We'd go until 3:45.
Our break would be approximately. You start at 4, right? So I can make sure we break it be 3:45. Yeah.
Well, I created space this morning.
Me too. So I'm fine with it.
Okay. Then we'll go back and do it. We'll stick with it at 2. Okay.
Can I say
something? Sure.
From some of the exercises we did yesterday, specifically with the throat, I feel very constricted in my throat in here.
As a result of the exercises, or you noticed it in the exercises?
I noticed. Well, actually, it seemed more open when I started, and then it constricted.
Uh-huh.
And then last night when I was trying to do the exercise in bed,
right,
I felt it.
Uh-huh.
And then I passed out dead asleep.
Uh-huh.
10 seconds.
Oh, that's effective.
Package that limit.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I just wanted to mention that because...
Okay, we'll work with it again today. And if it, you know, if you feel that, and you feel like in some way it's, you know, it's not helpful or kind of counterproductive for you to do that, then maybe just work with the throat in some other ways. I mean, of course, maybe with another exercise.
It seems like
it
really wants to open up, but I can't.
Right. Okay.
A challenge, an obstacle.
Well, maybe that's right, and you know, maybe sound can be a way in. I mean, I actually think it's a good exercise for working with the throat, so I would encourage you to stay with it, but
okay.
If you start to feel really uncomfortable, then you know, you have to make your own judgment. Okay.
I didn't hear quite how you were going to finish saying where personal issues fit in. You say it's not illegitimate to bring in, but is there any kind of routine or any, what's the attitude other than allowing it? I mean,
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question yet. I mean, we won't be doing an exercise, I don't think, that one comes to mind, but
come on, Jeff.
No.
So it's not the focus.
It's not the focus, exactly. What I was trying to say was that you know, we don't. You shouldn't have the sense that we're staying on such a high plane of abstraction, or you know, it's experiential, of course, but still kind of experience, a kind of a depersonalized experience. It's all right for it to be personal experience that you bring up, and you know, if it's important for you, absolutely, to share with the group. Is that clear enough?
Yeah, I guess. Coming from a different background, I wonder how say this week or the whole structure of TSK, what's the attitude towards vulnerability?
To the vulnerability?
Personal. Healthy and wounded.
Right. I think it's fair to say that in TSK there's a kind of a disinterest, I don't mean for that to sound harsh, a disinterest in the stories, the kind of person, the stories that go with our personality and who we are and how we got to be that way, and especially all that, the kind of story that explains us and justifies us and excuses us. And, you know, it's fine for that story to come up. It's actually very helpful to see those stories in operation. But the way that I sometimes talk about the difference between TSK and a more therapeutic approach, say, is that a lot of times in therapy you say you want to change the story. You know, there's a story in operation, and it's an unhealthy story, and it produces unhealthy results or negative results. And so you would like to make it be a different story. But in TSK, the sense is much more, you say, well, there's this story, and yeah, I can see it has unhealthy consequences, and there's the possibility of other stories, and you may find that you open up into other stories, and that's a good thing, but in the end, they're just stories.
No story is magic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's much more important to understand the story making
process.
Mm-hmm. And I personally, as I said before, I'm full of stories, right? I mean, not so much personal stories, but I love stories, I really do. and I think that in TSK, or I shouldn't say that, because this is something that I've thought about and it kind of grows out of TSK. You won't find it in the books exactly like this. there's two different levels of story, and I think that it's helpful to make that distinction. There's the stories that we tell, and they usually are backward-looking stories. They're stories that explain. They're the stories that you verbalize. Who was it who was saying the other day? There was that need to tell a story, to have the experience, to sort of...
turn it into words.
Turn it into words. Yeah, was that, who was that, was that Penn? Was that,
no, I think that was Lois.
Yeah. Oh, it was Lois, I'm sorry.
Okay. I said
yes. Okay, oh, that's right, yeah, I remember now. Okay. So that's the story that we tell. And then there's the story that we inhabit. That's how I think about it. In the way that a character in a novel inhabits that novel, or the movie.
But it's inhabited by that novel.
The character is inhabited by the novel?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I have to think about that. Yeah, in some sense, both. Well, it's like what we were saying before about the tree, right? The tree expresses the whole, or is sort of available for everything else that shows up. I think you only heard part of that, Deborah, because you were getting your glasses. Set within a context, the story that we inhabit, the story within which we dwell, and the story that we tell can be kind of a gateway into that. Or sometimes, you can tell a new story, and that will change the story that you inhabit. You can find yourself living in a different world because you've started to see things in different ways, and that's, I suppose, why they. Out of my depth here because I'm not a therapist, but that's why they call it the talking cure. You can talk yourself into living a different story. But I think the lived story is tremendously important to understand and see. This kind of analysis we've been doing of the self, the way we've been investigating the self. We're talking about the very ordinary way we think about the self, but it is part of our lived story. It's right at the center. Rinpoche calls it the founding story because he does talk about stories. The founding story is here I am. That's how he formulates it. And that's the story that we live. We don't ever tell that story because we just take it for granted. Right? Everybody knows that the self is at the center. But we live it. And that's the kind of universal autobiographical level, autobiography level, where we all share that in common. We all move in a world in which the self is at the center. And part of what we want to be able to do as a part of this process of calling the self into question, that's our theme, is just to become aware of that. And the one way to become aware of it is to play with it, is to call it into question, is to say, well, what would it be like if that wasn't the case? Or you can say, well, let me explore the way in which that is the case. And the practice we're going to do now is more kind of in the second category.
This might be a corollary, but twice when you said the past is going back and remembering, is focusing on the past, and I have maybe this is part of that too, but I experienced past stories as clues. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that they're interesting and intrinsic to anything now. I mean, I know that, can do that. But for me, I made a note yesterday is that I'm constantly hunting for ways that story that I tell and that I live and that I carry is helping me solve or resolve or open up the puzzle that I'm experiencing. So I use the past as a thing or a momentum rather than staying there, oh, this is what happened and so on and so forth. And I think that is very helpful to me to go in that direction so I don't feel completely confident in saying, oh, forget the past, live in the present, or, because it's information. It's very juicy, actually.
It reminds me of what we did when we touched the aliveness of a memory. We touched, and that sounds like what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You capture that energy that's alive in a memory or in a past, and you bring that forth into your experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. I mean, there was something on the floor the other day. I don't know if it was this floor or some other floor. And as we were doing an exercise, and I bent down and saw the floor, a flood of associations to a time, and it wasn't, oh, wow, blah, blah. It was as if the floor at the time that I, or whatever configuration I had seen once, was carrying some something laden of meaning, or I don't know, meaning might be too elaborate a word, that came up again now or in that moment. And I've always had the conviction that if I was able to slow down long enough and had enough core, whatever it is, of time, I could remember everything I ever thought or lived. And I'm just still waiting for that.
Good luck with that.
It isn't like it's over. So it's like an important, quote, dream comes again. You don't have to worry about its configuration. I mean, poems I write, you know, are retellings. So I just don't want to leave the past dead and buried in that sense,
right,
for me.
No, I actually don't think that that's... you know, the past is explanation, I don't think is very helpful.
Right.
I shouldn't say that. For some purposes, it could be helpful. If it leads to some kind of insight, then it can't. Then it can be helpful. But the past that really helps us connect with being here now. I don't want to get into using that phrase, but it is kind of a nice shorthand. But the past that helps us connect with the immediacy, let's say,
yes,
and the potential of our being, or something like that. You know, that past is the past that remains
alive,
with us,
it's
alive.
That's still present,
right,
if we can access it.
Right. And in fact, we will do some practices a little later. You know, that invite that kind of inquiry. And the other day, I gave a talk about a month ago at the Institute, a Sunday Dharma talk, it was a PSK talk. And in the course of preparing for that, because it had to do with present experience, and, I thought about that very famous passage, most of you have probably heard of it, in Proust, where he dips his... He dips a little cookie, a madeleine, it's called, into tea, and that triggers a flood of memories, you know. And, so most of you have heard of that, right? Well, I've heard of it too. I think I even read it when I was in college, but I certainly didn't really remember it. So I went back and looked at it. It's a very striking passage, very interesting. So maybe I will bring it in. I don't have a printed copy, but I have it on my computer, so I could bring it in into it. It's very interesting. I have to leave it at that, because I'm not going to try to say. The point is, people are always quoting it. They're always saying, oh, you know, Proust and the Madeleine, you know. But very seldom they go back and read it, I think. And the actual description is very interesting.
Well, that's the kind of experience I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's, It's not past. And in that book, in those seven volumes, he's saying you recover time through the process.
Right.
So it invokes it. And so it's important not to let it die if it serves.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
since I don't feel like there is a past, actually, so
mm-hmm.
I actually feel it's just the uncovering or loosening,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know.
Well, part of this is, you know, I want us to start practicing pretty soon.
Okay.
This is a good discussion. So, part of the reality of having or being a self is that you are inhabiting a story, dwelling in a story that is spread out across time. You have a past, you know, and you have a future. And that's true for you in this moment. And there are limits, you know, that create certain problems. Rinpoche writes in one of the, I think in Dynamics, he says something that's to me very interesting. He says, you know, we have this linear sense of time that there's a past back there and there's a future up here, and then there's the present, which is kind of a problematic place because it's always shifting. It's like, how can it even be there? It's kind of like the black hole that we've been talking about. But we have this threefold structure, and he says what happens is that the self involved in its story spreads its being out across time, you know, into the past and into the future. And as a result of that, it's like it's scattered, you know, it's you can't bring yourself together in a coherent way because your being has been spread out across time. Like, you know, like what are you doing? You're looking at a microscope, you make a smear, right? So you sort of,
mm-hmm.
you've got this sort of wholeness of being, and you smear it out across this two-dimensional structure of time. And so no wonder, you know, you can never really experience yourself or your reality fully. So that structure is problematic. But it's also true that if you want to understand or want to tune in to your the richness of experience, in a certain sense, you have to be able to collect back together what's been spread out across time. And so that, you know, the part of yourself that you think of or don't even think of, but that you just assign to the past, you know, or to the future, your intentions. You want to be able to access those. You know, maybe you don't want to say you want to access them in the present, because then that confirms the structure, past, present, future. Right? But those three dimensions of time can be available differently. And that's part of what TSK does too.
It's like Japanese calligraphy, you know. The very moment of making mark
mm-hmm.
is the quote collection
mm-hmm.
of all the experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no plan
mm-hmm.
and there's a readiness
mm-hmm.
and then there's giant white cloth
mm-hmm.
and then there's a
you
mark.
Do it,
and it's that mark that is
right.
The moment or the
right.
collection, the crystalline.
Everything comes together.
Is there. And you never know what it's going to be.
Right.
And you have to trust that. So it's amazing.
Yeah, Rinpoche says something that's kind of similar to that, knowledge of time and space. It's one of these places that I like, and therefore there's a few catchphrases in my mind. He talks about what he calls the decisive moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that.
Yeah.
Is related to what you're saying. Okay, well, let's do some practice. Now, I wanted to ask you, yesterday we did a lot of practice outside, more than I usually do. It seems to me there's a certain risk when you go outside of getting kind of, I don't know, distracted. But it's such beautiful weather and such a beautiful location, and In principle, in TSK, there's no such thing as distraction. It's you know, everything is available. Are you okay with that? People, yeah. Okay. So what I would like to do this morning, before the break, I guess. Let's see. Wait, we started at 9:33 hours. Think this through for a moment here. Let's start by going outside. There's this whole range of possible experiences, and we looked at that yesterday when we looked at it actually on Friday evening, that exercise that's called body, mind, thought, interplay, and we looked at it from a somewhat different perspective when we did the exercise from love of knowledge, which I forget what it's called, but it says at the end, you know, you're keeping notes, this annotated inventory of what goes on in your mind. You know. So what I want to do this morning is go into what goes on in our minds in terms of some categories, which, I'll be honest here, I've kind of adapted from Buddhist teachings. It's helpful to me to look at the Buddhist perspective. So the first category I'd like us to look at is sensations and the body. So what's going on within and outside the body? What's available through the senses, including the sense of proprioception, which is the technical term for being aware of what's going on in your body. And what you discover may not fit the usual categories. This is something anybody with meditation experiences, you know, has some familiarity with this, so I don't think we need to say too much about it. It's what you're aware of through the senses and what you're aware of is going on inside the body, and it may not be very well defined, you know, maybe like flow, movement. People talked yesterday about rhythms or frequencies or waves, what you said, Bruce. But the focus is on the senses and the body. And the part that I'd like to bring into that, beyond simply just being aware of it, is what we talked about yesterday at one point using the phrase two-way sensing. So whatever it is you're experiencing, there is also the sense of the one who's experiencing it. And not necessarily the one as someone with an identity, but just the fact that it is an experience of something. And that suggests an experiencer. You need to be a little careful there, because it may be that that sense of an experiencer is more of a construct. Yeah, that was the criticism that was made of Descartes very early on, not long after he published his discourse on method, I guess it was, where he talks, you know, he uses this phrase, I think, therefore I am, you know, but the real point he's making is, I've resolved to doubt everything I can possibly doubt, but because I'm doubting, there can be no doubt that there is someone who is doubting, right? I doubt, therefore I am.
So, are you saying whatever the experience, there is also an experience of an experiencer?
There is the activity of experiencing, and that's really what I wanted to say about Descartes, the criticism that was made when he said, because I'm doubting, I cannot doubt that I exist. And somebody very early on said, well, that's not quite true, because the assumption that there's someone who's doubting is an assumption. What you can't doubt is that there's doubting. Right? But to assign that to a doubter is another step.
That was the exercise yesterday of getting yourself in the context
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is we're kind of exploring the same thing from a different perspective. So I'm just saying, don't go around necessarily looking for the one who's experiencing. You may find that one, or you may not. But whatever it is, whatever, if there's a sensation or if you see something, there's not just what's seen, but there's the experience of seeing. That's more than
okay. That's better.
When you hear, there's the experience of hearing. If there is a kind of heavy feeling in your stomach, there it's a little more obvious because we don't name that in quite the same way. But there's the heaviness, but there's also the experience of the heaviness. So we always do this little this thing about focusing on the content of the experience, and I'm saying focus also on the experiencing. Don't have to worry so much about whether there's an experiencer. So we're going to do that in different modes, but the one I want to focus on now is the body and the senses, and I think that makes much more sense to do outside. So it's 10:20. Why don't we come back in here? I want to give us a little time, so let's be back in here at 10:45, okay, and then that'll give us a little time for it.
How many minutes is that?
That's 25 minutes.
Going back to the Netherlands, we sit, walk.
No, that's up to you. That's up to you. Thank you. is to finish it. Okay. So partly that, partly just the experience of the feeling, or rather the sensing, and partly this added dimension of a two-way sensing, experiencing, focusing on the experience as well as the content of the experience. So what would you like to say? What did you notice?
On that two-way, or that focusing on the experience as well as the content, that is a really rich exercise. And when I first went out there, I was a little overwhelmed by all the visual, there's just so much to see. So I slowly started focusing on things closer by, and started focusing on my hands, and the content of the was clear. And then I tried looking at the different levels of experience of sense that I could bring into it. So I brought my hands up to my nose and smelled them and saw them, and started moving them to make some sound, and got this real flow of like a multi-layered sensing. It was kind of neat. I played around with that for a long time. Not that was really a neat experience. Just kind of going back and forth between the content and then these different levels of experience that were just this continual flowing. Maybe it was the water in the background that got that flow sense going. There's a really clear sense of this ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think when we focus on the content, we, you know, we fit everything into its categories, kind of into its little slots. You know, this is this, and this is that. And when we bring in this other dimension, that loosens up.
Yeah. Very enjoyable.
I don't know if this is doing the exercise exactly, but one of the things that I found quite fascinating was being aware that some, you know, like the water is constantly going, but mm-hmm. sometimes I was aware of it, and sometimes I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and then even just looking, sometimes I was clearly seeing whatever was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
There was seeing happening that was registering, and I was aware, and there was awareness of that. And other times, especially if I got into thoughts, even though the light was still going into my eyes, I wasn't registering mm-hmm. seeing it. Mm-hmm. So it was just, that was just, was striking to me as a sort of, and this goes off a little bit, it made me think of this thing that I've seen on TV of, you know, looking at brain physiology that, and showing people words backwards. And when you were just, when the person was reporting just seeing lines, a certain part of the brain was activated, but if they recognized the word,
mm-hmm.
then a different part of the brain
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
active. So that was just, it was also a thought that I've been often too thinking of what, you know, like the sound of the water was still happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as far as I was concerned, it wasn't until I tuned into
right.
it. So there's something about who was, I don't know, that relates exactly to who was listening and who was listening, but that was where some of my time was spent.
Well, you know, I said we would be looking at different aspects of experience, and I don't know that we'll be able, how far we'll be able to get with that this morning, but if you say I'm going to focus on the senses, including the body, you know, then there's the things that come up other than the senses, and they're kind of like, you know, off to one side. That's not the practice, you know. But in another practice, that might be the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, ultimately, everything is kind of equally available, all those different alternatives. And I think it's really good to recognize how the mind is. Someone used the metaphor yesterday of changing channels, you know, constantly. Involved in very different things. We jump around tremendously. And good to notice that.
I think mine was somewhat similar to yours, but except that I realized that vision was dominating. Like, so if I was looking at something, that was kind of all that was really going on for a while. And then there was, but then there was this noise that stopped, so I wasn't sitting close to the water. There was this noise that stopped, and I realized I actually heard that noise,
mm-hmm.
and that because I noticed that it stopped.
The noise stopped.
So then it occurred to me that that was the experience without the experience, without the one who is having the experience,
mm-hmm.
perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because it was clearly there,
right.
perhaps only in retrospect. But it was clearly there, and I thought, oh, okay. Because I was really kind of figuring out how to approach it. So then I started to see if I could make vision less dominant. And so, which I found really tricky to do. But what I did was I focused on something sort of further away, and then there was this, or it didn't actually have to be further away, but that was kind of the way I did it. And then there was this seeing without, experiencing the seeing without actually focusing on seeing that particular thing. And I knew that it was there, and there was even an energetic component to that, to the seeing. There was just a tree that was sort of much closer. And I knew it was there, but I wasn't focusing on it. At least I didn't think I was focusing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that it felt like that was a bit more of the experience, having the experience of seeing without seeing. And so then I realized it was all the seeing, the feeling, the hearing was all happening at the same time. And it was just like what you said, tuning into the channels. And then I could be aware of the sensation of those things
mm-hmm.
without actually having to specifically tune in to all of those things, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of possibilities there, right? There's it's a topic that's debated a lot in the field of consciousness studies. Is when you do you always have some kind of background, peripheral awareness of, you know, various things, the feeling of your foot against the floor if you have it on the floor. You know, you certainly weren't thinking about that until I mentioned it, but was it somehow forming a part of your experience? Or is it more a question of really switching from one to the other, and kind of, you know, these different places? So when you talked about, you know, having an experience without an experiencer, when you talked about the sound that stopped,
mm-hmm.
and So that's an interesting way to think about it. In that particular debate, I tend to think that one doesn't have experience of things that one doesn't have experience of, you know. this idea, you know, but I also think maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's, you know, maybe there's some subliminal sense. The example that's used sometimes in the literature is you become aware of a clock that's striking three, let's say, and somehow you know that it's striking three, that it's, that's the third time it's rung, but you didn't hear the first two, but you know that this is the third. So in some sense, you know, you're able to go back.
It feels to a certain extent like the issue is awareness, like, you know, the sensation on your foot is, that's happening, as a matter of whether you're, I mean, something's happening.
Something is happening, right.
Whether
it
you're
makes sense
aware
to
aware
say that something,
or not.
You know, depending on what you mean by happening, it makes sense to say that something is happening. That's a, you know, that it is the third stroke of the clock, or that your foot, of course, is in contact with the floor.
But isn't it a good thing that we, that the mind or awareness can filter some things out? Because I think we would be very overwhelmed if we just heard and felt and saw everything at the same time.
That's right. That's right. That was William James at that point. He said he defined consciousness as a, I mean, roughly, I don't remember now, but as a device for filtering out experience. That's what human consciousness is for exactly the reason you said, that it would be overwhelming to take in everything.
But there's the whole theory that we take it all in,
mm-hmm.
and that the filtering happens at another level,
mm-hmm.
that it's all there,
mm-hmm.
and that at the level at which we start categorizing, labeling, and telling stories about the experience, that's
mm-hmm.
when the filtering takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like if you took a picture of this room, everything is in this room, but you might not focus on the you know, the titles of the books that are on the shelves, but that's in that picture.
Right.
And there is the theory that that's what is more like what happens
mm-hmm.
in terms of our experience of the world around us,
mm-hmm.
which is the theory I like.
You like that theory?
Yeah.
It's a theory, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at, you know, I'm not saying that it's wrong necessarily, but if you stay with experience, and that really is kind of the starting point, you know, there's something fundamental about the way we understand the world, I think, is that we do understand it in terms of matter. We, you know, even if we don't, I mean, even if we're not interested in science or not, you know, don't hold a materialistic view, kind of philosophy, and say the only thing that's real is matter, which is basically the position that science takes. I'm overstating it, but basically that's the position that science takes. Even if we don't hold to that theory, we tend to think of things that way. And the idea, as you say, that a picture of the room contains everything in the room, whether we notice it or not, is a kind of a corollary of that. But if you look in terms of experience, which is where we start, then the world is really different when you look in terms of experience. You know, if that's your starting point, then there's a lot of things that turn out to be theoretical constructs that you use to explain what your experience is like. But you really kind of have to start with experience. And that's, in a sense, what Descartes discovered. You know, and put it that way, he drew some unwarranted conclusions, maybe. But in the beginning is experience. You know, there is nothing but experience. And then there's various things we can say. And some of them, you know, and I think, from what you said, the reason it's appealing to you to say there's more than what we ordinarily experience is to say, well, there's this vast potential that we could experience. And that may be the case. And it may be that having a theory that says that allows you to explore different aspects of experience. and maybe you discover a depth to experience or a vastness to experience. And you know, that's what happens. It's what happens in Kunye, or it's what happens if you do an exercise like this. You discover things that you don't normally experience. But it's still experience. It's still, you know, the starting, the beginning and the ending is always experience. You know, it always happens within the realm of experience.
Except for the fact that there could be a broader experience which people then narrow down because they keep being told that this is the way experience is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's this, you know, I can't cite any references, but there's like they talk about children who have much broader experiences of reality than adults do.
Right.
And that they stop talking about their experiences because they keep being told that that's not, of course you don't see that, of course you don't hear that, of course that's not happening.
Right.
And so so I understand what you're saying, that all that each of us has to sort of go based on our experience, but we get told about what's sort of an acceptable
mm-hmm.
range of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so then either we conform
mm-hmm.
to that kind of experience, or every time someone tells us, we have to say internally or externally, that's not my experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess that's...
Yeah, we stop experiencing. Right?
Yeah.
And you know, that may well be the case. I'm just saying that, you know, I mean, I don't think we're disagreeing.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
So a classic example for this whole question is driving a car, you know, because everybody has that experience. And the experience of driving a car very often is actually a non-experience, in the sense that you don't notice anything about what you're doing. You know? And it's really quite amazing. It's a very sophisticated thing that we learn how to do. We drive from point A to point B, and we have no memory of having done so.
In a blackout.
Yeah, now it may be that you know, maybe we are experiencing it, and this is kind of another debate that goes on. We say, well, maybe we're experiencing, but in each moment we forget it. Right? You can't really tell the difference. I mean, you know, maybe you have the whole range of experience, but you don't remember it long enough to notice that you've actually had the experience. That's a theory.
Couldn't it be that you're just focused on something else? Your focus is, you're more focused on something else. It's not that you're not aware, maybe, of what's going on, but you're just more focused or more aware on something else.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, that particular model about driving, one argument or one example that's used is called the long-distance truck driver example, and it's like somebody, you know, who's been driving and they're driving late at night, and again, they've driven, you know, all night long or hours and hours, and they have no recollection of that time at all. It's just kind of a lights out, blackout experience. You know. That's kind of an extreme. You say, well, there was no experience at all. Even though the person, you know, was maneuvering through, well, at least driving down an empty road, it'd be hard to do that, I think, if you're maneuvering in traffic, but maybe.
Well, then you're then defining the experience as something you remember.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the memory issue is it's very hard to.
There was an I would say there was an experience that the person was having during that.
But that's kind of a theoretical construct, isn't it? I mean, you say, well, there must have been an experience because you can't do something like that without experiencing it.
Well, is that like saying that
well,
if you can't hear the tree fall, it didn't fall?
Experience, I mean, the word experience is a theoretical construct. I'm just not doing it. You're doing it. So
right.
You're using a word that, but you're not.
Right. So, but you need some word to be able to point at this realm. Experience may not be the best word, and actually, Rinpoche says, and TSK doesn't like the word too much because it suggests that there's someone who's having the experience, right? There's an experiencer, and it's making some presuppositions. But, you know, what is the difference between one of us and a rock, you know, in the relevant realm, it's you know, that we're aware or having experiences or conscious, you know, there is an aboutness to our experience, actually the way this gets talked about. This is a nice, very useful phrase. There's something it's like to be you or me, but there's not something it's like to be a rock. That's the way that's the distinction that gets made. Now, you know, yeah, you may say there has to be something, and maybe we just forget it. That would be a kind of a theoretical explanation. I don't know if that changes anything too much. But I wasn't quite finished with my example of the driving. There's this truck driver who we're hypothesizing just has a blackout. But what we usually do, we get into a car, we drive somewhere, and we are busy thinking about something else, right? And so we don't notice anything. And yet, there's some kind of background, you know, sensitivity, readiness to experience, because if someone breaks sharply in front of us, we react. I would imagine, I don't know if this is true, but I imagine that it takes us longer to react if we're lost in thoughts, as we say. But the fact is, you know, in one moment our experience is that we're busy thinking, and in another moment our experience is that we're aware of what's going on around us. This is what you were just describing, right?
What about the jolt you get? Like, I used to drive this certain way to see my mom, and it was beautiful. It was just beautiful. And then I would be just driving down, thinking and looking at clouds, whatever I do anyway. And then I would just, fear would just hit me. I'm lost, you know, because I wouldn't recognize the scenery. And it's like, you know, there's so much to intake that we don't intake it all. So then it would be a moment's jolt.
Right.
Jolt to be back into reality that, okay, I know where I'm at. But I've been driving all this time many times over there the same way. But I thought I was lost. I didn't recognize anything wrong.
I remember, I think it was the first, you know, I used to practice law for a little while. Sort of regular law. And the first time I did a trial, I remember after it was over, I was so engrossed in the whole process, you know. It was down in San Jose, and I was driving back up to Berkeley. And after I'd been driving about 45 minutes, I looked around, everything looked really unfamiliar.
Yeah.
And I realized that I'd taken the wrong road. Those of you who know the Bay Area, you know, I wasn't coming up Bayshore, I was coming up Highway, it was called 17 in those days, I think. But, you know, yeah, so I was coming up the east side of the Bay instead of the west side of the Bay. And I grew up on the west side, so I always take the west side. But I'd taken the wrong turn off. It was, you know, I was going in the right direction, and I'd been driving for 45 minutes before I noticed. And I was so engrossed in what had just happened at the trial.
That's very strange.
So, yeah, I mean, the fact that we have the ability, the capacity, or you might say the limitation of not being aware of, not having to be aware, and perhaps lacking the capacity to be aware of everything that happens to us, or to remember everything. You know, was that Borges' story? You were saying you would like to be able to remember everything that happened in your life.
I think I can.
You could. Only the circumstances. That's right. You could. That's right. Correct.
The causes and conditions for me to.
Yeah.
But how many lifetimes would it take to do that?
Because there's that
Borges story, you know, Funes and Memorias.
Yes.
About somebody who doesn't remember everything. He's basically paralyzed. He can't do anything. He lies in bed all day. Because he remembers everything.
Wow.
Okay, so that got a little delay here, but that's okay. Why don't we take our break? Since we're not meeting quite as long, let's make it a little shorter. So we have time to do one more round in this. So it's 11:18 by my watch. Let's just come back. This is only a little tiny bit shorter, but let's come back at quarter up. Let's try to really be here at quarter up, okay? Thank you.
experience has to have memory associated with it. It wouldn't be my
I think the way he was defining it was, I would say, for me, I think maybe a lack of a bit more variations of what do you mean by experience. So I'm not sure if it was very well defined. So if you said defining experience is something which you remember, then yeah, it wasn't an experience. The truck driver didn't have an experience, but I can't, obviously, it's my imagination, imagine that he wasn't experiencing something, he was thinking he was doing whatever, and he didn't remember that. Okay. It's like, you know, you're experiencing something, your nerve cells are reacting to your foot before coming up to your brain. It's just you're not, however our brain works, we're not tuning into that to be something that comes into consciousness. It would be my theoretical understanding of that.
Yeah.
So that's.
And there's all that theory about you could, under hypnosis, recall those things that you don't consciously recall, that you don't
right.
didn't consciously
right.
make note of.
Right. Again, like if somebody came up and, another way of thinking, Jack was talking, somebody came up and, you know, hit you on the back of the head and knocked you unconscious, you would definitely, you would be experiencing, you wouldn't, and then didn't remember anything. Up in, you know, after that point, your body would still be experiencing something obviously
mm-hmm.
quite traumatic. Could you remember it now? Does that mean you didn't experience it? I mean, sort of a drastic example of like there could be something that was happening, you might be in some unconscious state, whatever.
Or the flip side, people who have Alzheimer's or memory
mm-hmm.
impairments, they have experiences, right, that which they are in at the moment, but they don't remember them later.
Right, or have a context.
Yeah.
Or have a context for them, it seems, because it's sort of out of the blue and disconnected and not, you know, they're not in a relationship that they have a memory of having,
right.
having had a relationship with them.
Yeah.
Actually, I feel like I could have pursued it more, but I'm not sure. Since, I mean, the whole materialist idea, I mean, because my belief, and obviously it's a belief, is that you know, I'm fascinated, although I'm not well-versed in the neurophysiology stuff and the research that's happening and what how incredible the brain is, but there is a physical thing happening that's making experiencing possible, which I don't know is always compatible with Buddhism, although I think the Dalai Lama is actually very interested in talking to neurophysiologists and
right.
finding very interesting sort of, you know, connections there, but you know, that's where I struggle with some issues about, you know, what happens after the death of the body and talk about is there some part of being or soul that exists or not. I find it interesting. I don't. That's a part of Buddhism that doesn't really make sense to me right now.
Mm.
But that's a whole other
thing. It sure is.
Thing.
Kung Ye says there's something physical happening all the time. Like your experience is somewhat captured in the physical.
Right. Well, clearly, because I'm just paying attention to that, but then, and that's a practice, obviously, then, too, but are they saying that there's something, which I don't know enough to say, you know, certainly doing the workshop with Arnell, the, you know, the dead and dying, and he was clearly talking about there being something that continues
mm-hmm.
after death, from a Buddhist point of view, so he would start to put in there when we're talking about that. And as far as I can deal with that is, well, that's interesting to think about that. Well, I'm like, okay, so what if that was true? You know, think about, do I believe that right now? I would say no. Although it's, and more what was interesting to me about that was thinking of the idea of Bardo and how that applies to one's life than thinking that there's actual something that continues after the rebirth and all that, which can't quite go with. But I don't know. I can't say.
This is the problem. Can't
right.
prove that one.
Right.
It's always interesting about the things that we can't prove or demonstrate,
right. Right.
which is in a way what I thought Lois was asking about, which was, you know, there's a lot of talk like this is about
right.
stuff we all
right.
know.
No.
And
right, and I agree. I think that was like, so okay, so you do that, then what? What do you do with that?
Right.
It's like when I said this to her, and said this before. It's something I remember from when I was studying keto for a while. The keto teacher, you know, he was into all the different aspects of that as a discipline. But he would make the point that, you know, it's one thing to sit and meditate and have your own experience. You know, you're having some interaction with the environment. But part of why he liked and did a martial art was you were testing that out in a sense, always with another person.
Yeah.
Oh yes, I'm one with the world, and then you know, try to blend with somebody else's energy, and you're not so one with the world anymore. So how do you do that? And you can sort of spout sort of you know, truisms, but
yes.
How does that manifest itself in your day-to-day world, or interacting with people?
Yeah.
So I think that is exactly what Rosa is doing.
dream on my face. It's Tuesday. Yes.
It is.
We've been doing this for a long time. It just doesn't feel like it's only the midway through the second day.
No, it doesn't.
Well, there was that Friday night beginning.
Sunday.
Sunday night,
Sunday.
Yeah.
I know.
He said Friday too. No, for a second there, I almost had this. Did I get it wrong?
It was a couple days high.
Yeah. He said Friday. I was like,
Friday, yeah. Sunday, right.
Yeah.
Right. Sunday night, Sunday morning. There's something sort of timeless about this, I think, so that you lose track of time, the normal track of time.
The normal track.
Or you drop it and then pick it back up, or you drop it and then, or you just, it becomes timeless and then you just get pulled out of something.
Yeah.
And then over time, it's really difficult to, you can't mark it the same way.
Well, I find Rotten and Ling has really interesting time all on its own.
That's true,
it's
too.
Close.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, the combination of rattling time and TSK time.
Devilish combination. There is something about getting away from the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
What happens there? Is it just meditation?
Oh, it's
tended to be for meditation, chanting.
They'll have big classes over there. When we had the big Kumne retreat, there were 50 people. We did all of our classes in that room.
That's a beautiful room.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do they keep the prayer wheels on?
I did.
Was it nice?
It's beautiful. That big white building.
Yeah, what is that? Is that
that's for Dharma Publishing, their storage?
Storage, yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
why
storage.
I have books. It's big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you should see it. Yeah, well, you'll see the other ones over there, too.
Like, I know that they produce a lot for the development song.
Yeah.
When you see
it's
those big...
That's primarily what everything that's done over there.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the text.
Gives you a bit of an idea of the scale of everything.
Yeah.
It's a lot of books.
Bruce,
amazing.
I talked to you all the way up here, and then
and
I had
a
question.
I'm surrounded
with that.
My sister is
cooking to get to do the whole last year, and we used to roll bears, and we were trying to raise the money to get the books over.
How tall are you, Jack?
6 feet.
Why do you ask?
Because you just look very tall.
Well, that's good.
I don't know why, but I didn't think you would be as tall. But maybe it's because we are.
You look a lot smaller on my screen.
Mister, I'm really funny.
There's that famous story about Picasso and the nature of reality and all that. About somebody.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
the mother.
Yeah, or the wife.
Yeah.
That book, okay. Oops. Reminds me of another story, but I'm not going to tell you. You knew it would, right?
Story.
Right.
I love your stories.
Well, that's extra. So I will tell you. I'll tell it very quickly. It's just about somebody. There's many versions of this story. There's some people who are in. This guy is convicted of a crime. He's sent to jail. He's got a roommate in the jail, you know. And the first night in the jail, his roommate at a certain point just calls out to the whole, you know, everybody can hear everybody in this jail, and he calls out 42, and everybody bursts out laughing. And then somebody else calls out 36, and everybody bursts out laughing. And this happens a couple more times, and so this new guy says, well, what's going on here, you know? And he says, well, you know, we've been here so long, we know each other so well, we've got these jokes that we tell. So we just got a number, you know, and so we just call it up. and then people tell, you know, that people, okay, so people laugh. So this guy says, well, I can do that, you know. And so after a while, he calls out 18. Silence. He calls out 37. Silence. He said, well, what's wrong? I thought, you know, you guys just had these jokes. And he said, well, you know, some people just don't know how to tell a joke.
That's cute.
Okay. I think that was 2 minutes wasted. Had to with stories and, you know. Oh, laughter's good. Okay, laughter's always good. Okay.
2 minutes wasted.
That was 17. No, but I tell that story yesterday. But actually, that happens in India. I just did years ago. I was there once. And you walk into the telegraph offices, and they have these big lists of things that you tend to send in telegraphs, like, you know, my condolences upon your loss, and congratulations on your wedding. And they're all numbered, you know. And people send these telegrams, and they just send number 16, you know. And then the person at the other end gets it, and they see that it's number 16. The guy's saved all this money by not having to put all the words in. Yeah. So it's actually true. Yeah.
Is that why it's called Telegraph Avenue?
Telegraph Avenue, no. Okay. So we want to try another aspect of experience. You know, we were talking about the fact that one part of your experience is what you sense and experience of the body. So there's a number of different aspects of experience. We're not going to be able to work with them all, I don't think, anymore. Today. Maybe we'll come back to something else. So I'm going to suggest another one that is related, and this is a little more subtle now. And this is more subtle. Do it in here, and it has to do with what we were talking about stories and about how we inhabit a story. So when a thought comes up, or maybe an image, it's always situated. At least that's what we want to explore. That's the claim I'm making now, and you can explore it. It's always situated, and the idea now is to let experience arise, and it may be in terms of your sense experience, but it may be in terms of memories or thoughts, right? And whatever you notice, look for the story that supports it. So I'm going to give you an example, which is not the perfect example, but it works. Someone pointed this out once in terms of consciousness studies, and they were talking about how, you know, we say our brains or our minds are in our brains are in our heads, and that's the way it is. This fellow said, no, that's not true, even from a materialist perspective. And the example that he gave was, you have run out of milk, and so you want to remind yourself to get some milk the next time you go out, so you take the empty milk bottle and you put it next to the door. And he said, well, that's part of your brain, that milk bottle. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so concerned with whether it's part of your brain or not. But it's a very nice example, pretty good example, of of what it means to see something in context. You see that milk bottle, and it's not just that you say, oh, a milk bottle. You say, oh, I have to go to the store, or I have to get milk at the store. Right? So that's an example of a story that comes along with the specific object.
I saw it as when you get that milk bottle and you go outside and you see somebody that's really hungry, you offer them the milk bottle so they can go and get milk.
But they still have to pay for it. Though.
That's true.
Okay. Well, maybe that's your story. 23.
So the association kind of with cues that show up, see mm-hmm. what is the associated story? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so in this example, it's a cue, and but I, that's, you know, I don't want to limit it to cues. It may just be, you know, you hear a bird outside, and it reminds you of hearing a bird yesterday, or reminds you of the birdhouse that you built in your backyard, or you feel a little pain in your knee, and you know that triggers a certain story that you tell yourself about, oh, my knees are getting bad and I'm going to have an operation. Right. So and you know, remember I said before that Rinpoche writes that the founding story is here I am, and it may be that you can notice something like that, but I wouldn't go fishing for it too much because you know you want the experience to come in a kind of a natural way. But stories can happen at a lot of different levels. I mean, that's a story that you notice usually, but there may be other stories like this. But the notion is that an experience, any moment of experience, is not an isolated thing. It brings with it a complete world, you could say, in some contexts, or a story in which that particular experience makes sense. And those are shifting. They shift all the time. That's what we want to look at. Okay? So we'll do that for about 25 minutes.
Okay. Take a couple of minutes to write if you like. too long to finish up. So we have a few minutes to reflect on this together. Anybody want to say anything?
I kept thinking of the book Out of Our Heads, Alvin Noe, is that how to pronounce it?
Alvin Noe.
Yeah, I just heard it recently. That's what it kept triggering that, but I also thought about how can we trigger new knowledge. New stories,
mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I was thinking about that and how so constantly things keep coming up,
mm-hmm.
that are based on old stories. How do we break that,
mm-hmm.
and share something new?
So stories might help with that, it's true. It's not, you know, in a kind of broad way we could say, the knowledge... What's the best way to say it? The knowledge that comes through stories is not really the knowledge that we're interested in, but a new story can make new knowledge available. It can be a gateway. That's how I tend to think of it. You know. So TSK is like that. I mean, you know, from shape from time to time, the TSK book says, "Well, you know, this is just a story too." But it's meant to be a story that invites new possibilities, allows for new possibilities.
I have a question, but I don't know if it's appropriate. So please feel comfortable to say it's not appropriate, and we talk about it another time.
Okay.
I have been continuously comparing my Dharma studies recent TSK, and I'm so drawn to this, and I still see a gold mine of explaining it in a very clean, clear way. But then, I don't know why I'm stuck in this kind of dual thing of comparison,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think you're in the position to kind of give me some jolt or help.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, when I was meditating this now, I was thinking that, you know, when I eventually be able to stabilize more and more moments of, hey, here's another weaving story comes. So it slowly, life could get a taste of illusory dreamlike, because I do see how I weave and I weave and I weave and I weave and I weave. That awareness kind of cultivates. That I could see his weaving continuously, okay, I'm more free then. I'm not so stuck in these weavings and making them so real. Which is the way that two Dharma studies after the cushion and meditation look in between the practice life as an illusory dream, like, which is in accordance. Then there's part of me says, but what happened to that one side of the coin being this wisdom, emptiness of all these stories and reality that I give? The other side of the coin was supposed to be this compassion and they're not separate. but I haven't. Even yesterday when I felt this wind and this peace and all of this expansion, the humbleness of the compassion, and it's missing. At least I'm so new, and it's so, I'm just having moments of it, so I don't know. But you, the one who could perhaps say, is it maybe fair, or is it wrong to say this may be the Shravakana Yanas, that you get the wisdom, the emptiness, but you are missing that juice of the compassion, that compassionate peace, that you become very wise story after story, but not that I want to be in the service of the universe. Am I imagining, or is there, because I know you have a Dharma background.
Yes, I do.
So is that weaving that I just was imagining kind of grounded in some sort of knowledge and experience you have, or no? Because I don't know.
So, comparisons are not really so helpful. And we talked about that the first night, and you were just raising the question, why is that important for you? But, and it's a good question to ask. The question, what about, people put it different ways, what about love, what about the heart, what about compassion, where is that in TSK? And Rinpoche, I think it's fair to say it's not a big theme in TSK, but he does make it pretty clear that the flavor of experience, if we can use that word as kind of a shorthand, because it's not quite the right word, the flavor of experience, when this strong commitment to the self is not active, is one of openness, acceptance, love, joy, compassion. It comes there. And she's very aware that people miss that some in TSK. And I know, I think it's at the end. I can't remember, maybe in the preface to Love of Knowledge, he says, he sort of promises something about that, something that's mentioned at the end of the TSK book, which I'm sure is what Tina is.
Yeah, I think it's in this one.
He says, well, so sometime we have to talk not only about great time and great space and great knowledge, but great love.
KTS.
KTS, at the end of KTS, or preface, okay.
But it's also in the Love Knowledge preface, and he says exactly that he, at some point he's going to look into not only love knowledge, but knowledge of love.
And here it says, knowingness can help to maximize the love, intimacy, and fulfillment we experience in life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great, the last chapter in this book is awesome.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. So it's there. It's not especially emphasized. He does say, this is actually a nice phrase too.
It's almost like it's just a natural happening that after we break through the limits, the natural thing that bubbles up is the joy and the compassion and the intimacy.
It's something like that.
Yeah.
That's right. So he does, say, at the end of the preface to Love of Knowledge, he says, love and caring are faculties active in each human being, even if they manifest only as greed or selfishness.
Wow.
Or even as self-hatred.
That's pretty powerful right there.
Yeah. And there's a sense in which that's so clearly true, but I won't try to say more about that right now. So, despite the difficulties and deceptions to which human beings are prone, devotion and loyalty are native to the human spirit. But when knowledge is limited, this is really the heart of it, you could say, when knowledge is limited, love and devotion are easily distorted. When observation is confined to the objective realm, individuals tend to submit their sense of worth and well-being to the objects they encounter. Unaccustomed to investigating the workings of the mind, the operation of the self, or the potential range of knowledge. And that's a nice summary of what we're investigating, mm-hmm. you know, trying to, the workings of the mind, the operation of the self, or the potential range of knowledge. They lose sight of ways of being that can be deeply healing and nourishing. This pattern, love led by limited knowledge into fruitless ways of being. That's a lovely phrase. Love is led by limited knowledge into fruitless ways of being. Reduce the limitations on knowledge, that changes. Affirms the value of the love of knowledge, awakening the innate human capacity for devotion and appreciation. Love of knowledge can transform our lives. I think I'll stop there. That's enough. So, it's a good question, it's an important question, you know, because if you have the sense that in this vision something is missing that you consider deeply important, then either you should turn elsewhere to find what is important, or you should question that sense of limits and find, you know, ask yourself, is that really an accurate reaction to the vision? Or if you say, I'm not finding it in my experience, and that's a great place to look. You know, so where is the love and the appreciation? So there is, I'll come back to that a little tonight, I just love. Okay, well, we're out of time. I was going to suggest an experiment, but I'm going to take a vote here, and the majority will rule. And that is that during lunch, we not use the word I. That'll make people a little self-conscious at first, but I do encourage, you know, the point is not to sit in silence. That would be nice too, but that's not the point.
I want to sit in silence.
That might be the easy way out. That might be the easy way out, though.
That would be the easy way out. So this would be, you have to kind of take it on as a challenge to say, so that's my question. So how many of you would like to try that?
Sure.
Okay.
Cheater word.
Right. And no, I think probably it's cheating to just use the, you know.
Our names.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, right. Come on, right. Now. We can't cheat. That's not fair.
So you can go ahead and eye all you want, but then you sit down. And then we'll see if we can keep a conversation going or if we'll just fall into awkward silence.
Can we use Bruce's new language he created? That's, I don't know it, but you can teach it to us. Is there an I in it, Bruce?
When I was 20, I created a language that has no nouns and no pronouns.
Wow. So there's no I?
Right. No I. It functions just through process and perspective.
That is so cool.
Subject and object.
You need a crash course.
Yeah, give us a crash course, mate.
It sounds German or something.
Are you German? Okay.
I'm very passionate about this case.
We forgot how long it should be over here. We are definitely on special time. Thank you.
an experiment, though. It's difficult.
Okay. Suggested in one of his books that I think he says do it for a day.
Would be a great challenge. It's actually really an experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.